I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. If you are all plugged in to the contemporary conversations about unplugging, then you know all of those public dialogues about the merits of disconnecting, either disconnecting from social media or from smartphones with all their apps and their screens, not totally going back to nature and roughing it, but somehow defanging the sharp teeth of the digital world that seizes so many of us and clamps down on our time, our energy. That's a really tight jaw clamping down on us from time to time. It just won't let go. If you have read or heard about resisting the wired life, it's possible that even you yourself have tried to address the problem. Maybe you've done some digital fasting. Maybe you've made an attempt to minimize the power of the digital age over our lives with all its devices that beep and notify and then download and ask you to accept cookies. You know what I'm talking about. Well, our next guest has a story to tell that marries some of these concerns, not just to lifestyle, but to a specific geographic spot in Appalachia known as the NRQZ. Well, what is the NRQZ, if you've not heard about it? It is the United States National Radio Quiet Zone. It's in the Blue Ridge and Allegheny Mountains along the border between Virginia and West Virginia, and it's there to facilitate scientific research and the gathering of military intelligence. And because of all of this, radio transmissions are heavily restricted. Our guest, Stephen Kersey, decided over a decade ago he was done with his cell phone. He gave it up. That's an odd thing for a journalist to do, you know. And then when he heard about an Appalachian town in the NRQZ, that place without Wi-Fi, without cell service, he wondered if he was lucky enough to have found a personal Walden Pond. So he went there to find out what the place was like, and now he's written all about his experience in a book titled The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Stephen Kersey, welcome to our show.
Marcus, thanks for having me on. That was a great introduction. I feel like I should have you ghostwrite my next book.
Well, I love the whole concept here. And Walden is a fun word to start with. And yet you were disappointed.
I was disappointed. Disappointed and also still fascinated, though. Because when you're a journalist going into a place and what you think it is turns out not to be the reality, and you start peeling back the facade and going down the wormhole, in this case of the Quiet Zone, several wormholes, it just gets all the more interesting.
There's a little footnote already I want to go into, that you and I are connected by phone, or how are, cause, and are you in that zone right now, and are you doing what you're supposed to?
Yeah, I'm talking to you live from the Quiet Zone. I'm just a couple of miles away from the telescopes. I'm within this somewhat sacred 10-mile radius where supposedly all electronic emissions that might interfere with the telescopes are supposed to be outlawed, punishable with a $50 daily fine. But I'm talking to you over an iPod, which is emitting electromagnetic radiation, and I'm using Wi-Fi to connect to the internet, which also emits a renegade signal. And nobody's knocking on my door yet to say, hey, you're in handcuffs because you're breaking the Quiet Zone rules. So yeah, just right here, this gives you a sense of how things aren't quite as quiet as they seem here.
You said handcuffs. Do you mean that literally or figuratively?
So when I first came here, that was a question I had. Like, how do they enforce the Quiet Zone rules? How do they keep it quiet here? And on one of my first visits in 2017, I went on a drive around with Chuck Nida. He's known as the Quiet Zone cop. He gets in this big truck, which has all these antennas sticking out on the roof that allow him to essentially track down sources of wireless interference that might be making the area noisy and thus making it harder for the radio telescopes here in Green Bank to be able to observe the incredibly faint, minuscule energy waves bouncing in from the universe. So I'm with Chuck in his truck. We're driving around. And before we even get out of the observatory's parking lot, we get like 6 Wi-Fi signals pop up on his computer screen inside the cab. We drive around town and we pick up like more than 100 signals, and some coming from the people's houses who I know. And I knew. So then like afterward, I go up to their houses and I say, hey, do you have Wi-Fi? Because, you know, I went on the drive around with Chuck, and so I knew they had Wi-Fi. And they're like, yeah, I do. You tell me in the law where it says I can't have it, too. It's the case where people, so many of them have Wi-Fi now that it's become impossible for the observatory to crack down on it. And it's the case that the observatory has actually essentially given up on trying to crack down on it, which essentially makes it not illegal anymore, right?
Yeah, so you're talking about rampant noncompliance. Is the whole concept here compromised to the point where we shouldn't even call it a quiet zone anymore?
No, no. It's still much quieter than other areas of the United States. So there's a couple of different things here when we talk about the quiet zone. One, there's this state law. It's called the West Virginia Radio Astronomy Zoning Act. It was passed in 1956, which is the same year the observatory was established here in Green Bank. And that mandates that 10-mile radius where if you're emitting interference, you're breaking the law, essentially, the state law. Then there's a federal national radio quiet zone passed in 1958, the one that you mentioned a couple minutes ago. And that one, essentially, it makes it so that if you want to install anything, if you want to install a cell antenna or two-way communications radio or ham radio repeater, you have to get approval first from the quiet zone administrator who is based here in Green Bank. It's much easier to say no to things like that before they're installed. When you have to get, by federal law, you have to get approval. It's much, much harder, right, to try and keep somebody from driving over to Walmart, picking up a router, and bringing it back in. And it's also the case that if you want to have internet, you almost by default have to have Wi-Fi. I was talking with a family. They live right next to the observatory, and they were abiding by the quiet zone regulations, the state regulations, for forever, until finally their old dinky modem blew. They called up Frontier Communications, who's the main provider out here, and the guy came, installed a new router, and by default, that new router is wireless. You can connect them to it by cable, but it's always emitting a Wi-Fi signal no matter what. They don't have an option now. And the observatory can't say you can't have internet, right? Internet is such like an integral part, underscored by the fact that the observatory itself has probably the fastest internet connection in this whole area because it has a dedicated broadband. It underscores how difficult it would be for the observatory to really try and crack down in any way on the quiet zone. That said, there's a lot more nuance now to what it means to be living in a quiet zone that really hasn't been portrayed accurately, I feel, and locals feel, in a lot of the media articles about this place.
What about the traditional radio transmissions? I mean, here I am. I'm a radio host. I like radio, and we send our signal out. Is that kind of a thing present in the area, in that 10-mile radius where people are listening to radio shows?
Yeah. So radio is definitely curtailed here, but there are some radio signals. Now, you know, radio is interesting because I think it's below FM 100, the astronomers don't observe. They don't observe radio frequencies coming in from space below that. And so mainly the radio that you have around here is below FM 100. The nearest radio tower to the observatory is exactly like 1 mile away. It's just on the outside of that 10-mile radius protected by state law. And it's also an extra low-powered antenna emitting those radio signals so as to not, you know, really pollute the airways of the observatory. You can still have radio, but they'd have to jump through some extra hoops to get it to be okay here.
So in the history of our country, there are these things called blue laws, where things are on the books and you're supposed to comply with them, but over time society changes and the books are antiquated, but they stay on the books. Is this a good analogy to what's happening in the quiet zone?
Maybe a little bit, yeah. It's a real life case of it happening, though. You know, when I think of blue laws, I'm from Connecticut, and until a couple of years ago, you couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays, right? That's an example of the blue laws. But like, that law actually had fangs. You really couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays, and you would lose your liquor license if you had it. Whereas here, you can have Wi-Fi, even though it says in the state law you're not supposed to be emitting that electromagnetic interference. You know, there's a whole other issue here over whether or not, like, how to interpret that state law and the federal law. And that's because they were passed so long ago. Think about the late 1950s. Like, maybe we had color television. I don't know if we did yet. we had, you know, fledgling radio, you know. It was still pretty basic. There was no there was no internet. There was no stellar smartphones. We couldn't even dream of that. Like, Dick Tracy's smartwatch hadn't even been invented yet, I think, then. So, like, those laws, they just don't explicitly say you can't have Wi-Fi, you can't have smartphones. And while the observatory has taken the stance, you're not supposed to have, by saying you're not supposed to have Wi-Fi, you're not supposed to have smartphones, that's against the state law. Other officials within the National Radio Astronomy Observatory who I spoke to actually said, that's not true. You can have Wi-Fi, you can have smartphones. The state law does not apply to those things, nor does the federal law. So beyond it being this case of like the observatory not enforcing it, to some extent, they're not enforcing it because it might not actually be enforceable in a court of law. It's never actually been tested. In the entire history of the Quiet Zone, the observatory has never fined anybody that $50. It just kind of looms as a threat, but without any real teeth.
Now, we've been talking about this place, and earlier I mentioned that you had come to the place to kind of figure out what life is like there and if it's really substantially different. But I want to go to your own story, because I also mentioned that you'd been a decade without a cell phone. And so describe your own walk through life without a cell phone for a decade. What's that been like?
It's been jumping through a lot of hurdles, kind of like how the radio station and other people here have to go through some extra hurdles if they want to, you know, get online. So did I, as being a person without a cell phone. Now, I can still hear the sound of my cell phone dropping into a trash can when I threw it away. I literally threw it away back in 2009. It was this old Samsung flip phone. I was traveling internationally. It wasn't going to work anyways. I just kind of wanted to like get a break from it and save some dollars by not buying a fancy new smartphone and investing in a data plan that was going to lock me in for several years of a couple hundred dollars a month or whatever. That initial trivial decision has since morphed into this obstinate refusal to get a device that everybody is telling me to have, even though we all live without them just 15 years ago, and also a device that more and more research shows isn't necessarily great for us to have all the time. There's plenty of research saying that smartphones are eroding our attention, making it harder to sleep, causing an uptick in accidents, making it harder to concentrate. Test scores have been proven to go down when smartphones are allowed in the classroom, and they've been shown to go up when Wi-Fi and smartphones are taken out of the classroom. There's plenty of reasons to be taking a break from it. And for me also, there's this recognition that they're addictive. It's really, really hard to like take a break from that. Some people, maybe they have enough self-control to be able to turn off their device or flip it upside down or leave it in the car or in the glove compartment. But I know that like my personality is such that when I'm around Wi-Fi, around a computer, I find it really hard to not refresh the screen, to check my email, to check Twitter, or to be looking at it surreptitiously if it's my iPod. And so for me, that decision not to have a smartphone was a bit of a recognition of like, I just think this is a better way to live. Green Bank, you can imagine, when I read that it's a place where supposedly nobody has smartphones, where Wi-Fi is illegal and cell service is illegal, this sounds like a modern-day Walden. This sounds like the thing we're all searching for. And in a real way as well, that's why so many articles around this place, I think, paint it as a place where those are all the case, where people don't have cell service or smartphones or Wi-Fi. Because it is nice to imagine that there is this Walden, that there's this paradise where we can go to like live a little bit more human again, the way we used to be just 15, 20 years ago.
So you philosophically were already of a mindset that you wanted even more of a disconnection, more than just getting rid of your cell phone, more than not just being on a screen all the time. You wanted to go to a place that you had envisioned would help you with your self-discipline maybe?
Yeah. And where it wouldn't be asked of me to have a smartphone. I mean, how many job interviews have I gone into or conversations that I had with friends where they just say, oh, you don't have a smartphone? Well, end of discussion for this job. Or if you only had a cell phone, I would invite you to this party. Or, you know, I'll text you, you know, text me when you're getting close or text me when you're in the neighborhood. It's like, I just can't do those things. And that requisite to life, like as if you have to have a smartphone if you want to be a member of modern society, it sounds like that just wouldn't be the case here in the Quiet Zone. And so I thought, maybe this is where I can fit in. Maybe this is the last place where I can just be a normal person again, by not having a smartphone.
Do you think that in the area around Green Bank, in that zone, in the quiet zone, do you think that the socioeconomically there's a greater or number amount of these cell phones or what devices, I should say, just socioeconomically? I mean, some people cannot afford those plans or those devices.
I remember being in the local school here, Green Bank Elementary Middle School. It actually abuts the Astronomy Observatory's property. It's soccer fields. It feels like the telescopes, the largest ones, are like looming over the soccer fields there. And I was in a classroom of third graders, and I just did a poll. Who here has a smartphone or a cell phone? Everybody raised their hands. I spoke with an eighth grader who was actually in trouble that same day for creating like a hotspot that he was using with his smartphone so he could like text his girlfriend and stuff. And his teacher, his music teacher, told me, you know, some of these kids are very poor, and yet they still have the latest fancy iPod or whatever. Like, even here, like, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the case that worldwide today, more people have access to cell phones than they do running water. Like, that shows you how ingrained they are in everyday life.
I want to talk with you a little bit more about the people you met there. We're going to do it after a short break. I understand there were some somewhat eccentric people who arrived in town specifically, and then there were the natives who'd been there, their families, for generations and generations. You found that all was not exactly copacetic, I'm going to say, in the town of Green Bank or environs. We'll continue the conversation with you, Stephen, in just a moment here on Constant Wonder.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenere.
I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. Stephen Kersey is with us. He's author of The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Well, it's a great subtitle, Suspended in Silence. And yet, from everything you've described to me, Stephen, it sounds like without a lot of compliance to not being connected with Wi-Fi and not sending out radio transmissions or signals, town's no longer quite suspended in silence, is it?
Not as quiet as it used to be, but there is still this sense of it very much being quieter than the rest of America, and a quiet culture kind of permeating the area in a lot of ways, where people don't like to talk about certain things, where the news isn't really covered in a robust way here because it's so quiet, and where things kind of lurk in the darkness that people would rather not talk about. There's a darker side to quiet that I found as well here.
Were you able to tease out any information about that area really being culturally distinct in this manner of silence? Any real difference qualitatively from other rural areas, say in West Virginia, you know, north or west from where you were?
Well, there's absolutely the case that the Green Bank Telescope and the observatory, an analogy I like to think of is it almost creates like a magical bubble around this area that like wards off the darkness being a socioeconomically poor area where there aren't a lot of opportunities economically or educationally. The observatory is this incredible beacon of science in the middle of remote Appalachia. It provides hundreds of jobs, many millions of dollars of economic impact in the community, and it's also a strong presence in the schools. The director of the observatory is the coach of the elementary school's robotics club, which won a statewide robotics competition and went to the World Robotics Championships just a couple of years ago. So there's this real sense of the observatory like creating a different culture in the quiet zone around Green Bank than elsewhere in Appalachia, for sure.
So it sounds like a love-hate relationship with the place. We're going to benefit from it being here, and yet we kind of resent the fact that we have these restrictions.
That's a perfect way of putting it. That, yeah, absolutely. Like, plenty of people say, man, my life would be so much easier if I could just have Wi-Fi and not have to worry about, you know, am I breaking the rules or not? Or it'd be so much easier if my internet is so slow, my wired internet is so slow, if I could just have a cell service, you know, so I could have a backup connection. Or I would be a lot less nervous maybe driving around, or if I had a flat tire or driving over these mountain roads, if I had a cell service and I could call for help or whatever. But at the same time, yeah, absolutely. There's the recognition that if you got cell service, you would probably lose the observatory and you'd lose all those jobs and that impact on the community that it has.
Now, there are people not unlike you who made the decision that they wanted to be in such a place. And in this group are some people who felt like radio waves are going to harm their bodies. Tell us about these people.
So there's a fairly new illness that many people in the world feel that they have. It's called electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And there's actually a character in the show Better Call Saul who has this. You might remember him if you saw the show. He kind of wraps himself in a metal sheet blanket, like a tinfoil blanket, and also like keeps his house totally off the grid because he believes that electricity, that modern-day electromagnetic radiation from Wi-Fi, from cell service, from cell antennas, from your microwave, from your refrigerator, he can sense those, and they're causing him pain to the point of debilitating him and maybe even to death. Hundreds of people like him have moved here to Green Bank over the past 10 years because they believe this is like their last refuge in a noisy world. It's the only place where they can get away from the pain.
Now, I've met people who have a sensitivity to various aromas, and they want to have they call it scent sensibility, I think. Is this a group of people who are validated by medical science?
Yeah, you know, it's like the vaccine debate. You can find somebody to back up what you want to believe, right? And so for these electrosensitives, I had many conversations with them, and they would say, you know, there's 20,000 studies proving that this is the case. And they would hand me a couple of them, and they would email me, you know, study after study, which in my own digging into it kind of fell apart under closer scrutiny. I don't think that there's strong evidence that people can actually sense Wi-Fi or cell service, or that this EHS actually exists. But, you know, nevertheless, plenty of people and prominent people, from the former director general of the World Health Organization to the CEO of Twitter, say that they can sense electromagnetic waves and they feel better when they're not surrounded by it. So it's a growing thing in society. I think that maybe this is just a symptom, an extreme symptom of like the tech overload that we all feel at one time or another, whether it's, you know, having a bazillion tabs open on our computer or not being able to get away from our smartphone, which is constantly digging. Don't we all like yearn for this chance like to break away and find some quiet? And so for these people, Green Bank, this is where they can find it in a very real, real way. They're also not too happy when they find that it's not as quiet as billed. Some of these electrosensitives have been known to go to people's houses in the area, knock on doors saying, hey, I'm picking up Wi-Fi from your house, and you have to turn it off for the good of both the Radio Astronomy Observatory and for my own health, because you're killing me with your Wi-Fi. And you can imagine that's created some tensions in the community.
You say some tensions in the community. Can you qualify that? Is there a divided town anywhere in the zone? Are there hostile kinds of interactions?
There's a woman. She was considered the first electrosensitive to come to the area. Her name is Diane Scow, and she had some particularly aggressive behavior when it came to enforcing or asking for quiet. She turned off the lights at a community square dance and some people fell down. She turned off the lights because she felt irritated by those lights. She asked somebody at the Dollar General to turn off her hearing aid because she said that she was feeling interference from that person's hearing aid. At the community center, at the Senior Citizen Center, she unplugged the fish tank because the air filter was bothering her. The fish were all found dead. You can imagine that in each of these cases, locals anywhere, and especially in an insular remote community like this in Appalachia, people wouldn't quite take kindly to that. Diane, at one point during the thick of this, years ago, she found a dead woodchuck stuffed in her mailbox. It had been shot to death. And it was a not-so-subtle message from the locals saying, you're not welcome here. Her car tires were actually slashed one time. Again, a message, we don't appreciate your behavior and you're telling us what to do. You need to adapt better to the way of life here that we have. Those tensions have since calmed down, and there's more of like a truce in the community between the electrosensitives and the locals, with them just kind of like more accepting the way that things are here, it not being quite so quiet, and also them recognizing if they want to be really, really quiet, they're going to have to maybe not go to Green Bank proper. They're going to have to go deep in the woods somewhere and find like almost like a quiet zone within a quiet zone to really get away from it all.
Now, Stephen, why would you bring up the National Alliance, a group of neo-Nazis in this area as well? Is this just a happenstance? Is it just coincidence? Or is there some connection between, I want to say, a bit of a surge of neo-Nazis in the area? Is that tied in any way to the nature of the Quiet Zone?
So I found that since the Quiet Zone was created, you know, it's naturally quiet here, but it's also stayed quiet because of the state and federal laws. And that quiet has had like a magnetizing, attracting force to people and groups who wanted to get away from it all, not just the astronomers and the NSA spies, but also back to the landers and hippies. They were looking to get away from it all. And then after them, in the 80s, the neo-Nazis, a very prominent neo-Nazi leader named William Luther Pierce, author of a book called The Turner Diaries, which has been linked to dozens of incidences of terrorist, far-right terrorist violence over the past half century. He came here to the Quiet Zone just south of Green Bank because he could get away from it all. He could get away from law enforcement. This is a Rhode Island-sized county where there's only one sheriff and a handful of deputies. If you don't want to be bothered, you can come out here to the Quiet Zone. You're not going to find many minorities. You're not going to find many civil rights groups. You're not going to find a robust news environment. This is a place, it's quiet. He could get away from it all, and he could pursue his very evil philosophy here from his remote mountain compound, which he did for about 20 years. And at one point, he had like a $1 million hate media empire, pumping out books, literature, magazines, hate core music. And he had about two dozen full-time staffers at his National Alliance compound here in Pocahontas County in the Quiet Zone. Absolutely. It was somewhat of a, you know, of a coincidence, but at the same time, he was very much attracted to the quiet.
Well, Stephen, here is probably the most important question of them all that I have. I've kept it in my back pocket for now, which is, were you naive when you came to the place? Were you really blindsided by what you found and surprised? And did you really see irony there? And how disappointed have you been? And just the follow-up question I'll tell you right now is there enough of a magnet there for you to want to stay?
So even before I came here, of course, you know, the skeptic in me was suspicious. Is it really as quiet as all the articles say it is? Do they really not have Wi-Fi or smartphones? And who's going to know? So honestly, when I started finding out that there was more Wi-Fi and smartphones than had been portrayed in a lot of articles, I wasn't totally falling off my chair. I was surprised at the level of which locals were playing along with the story. As an example, I was at a local general store, and I saw a son and his father there. The father's actually a local minister, and the son had told me before that they didn't have Wi-Fi at their house. And so I'd been hearing that people did have Wi-Fi, and I was like, hey, do you guys still not have Wi-Fi at your house here in Green Bay? They're like, yep, no Wi-Fi, the dad says to me. I'm like, oh, really? Because I'm hearing more and more people do have it, so why don't you? And the dad kind of pauses and looks at his son and kind of looks around. And he's like, oh, actually, we do have Wi-Fi. So he was a man of God, a brethren minister who was willing to lie to me. Like, where else in the world do people feel like they need to keep that hidden in the closet because they're afraid of, you know, how it's going to look in an article? I was surprised by that. I was also surprised by the level of it being not quiet, but being not quite what I thought it was going to be. Like initially, like I said, it sounded perfect. It sounded like a Walden, a place where cell service was non-existent, where people happily lived without cell phones and a more disconnected life. And as part of that, I heard about, you know, this hippie doctor named Patch Adams, who was here and was supposedly running a free rural hospital for Appalachians in a community that really could use better health care. Then coming in here and finding people do have Wi-Fi, and this hospital is non-existent, even though Patch Adams has raised millions and millions of dollars for it over the past 40 years. And not just that, but up the road is this very notorious neo-Nazi organization, which of course I didn't expect to find when I first came here. There was this very strange feeling of going down a wormhole and finding a place that was in so many ways not what it seemed. At the same time, being a journalist, that contrast of of light and dark was very rich from a storytelling perspective, and it was very, you know, beguiling to fall down this wormhole and to be digging into this culture of quiet that existed here in so many different nuances and in very complicated ways over the past half century.
Well, I'm no psychologist, but the term cognitive dissonance seems to come to mind in a situation like this. And I'm wondering who's got the greatest cognitive dissonance going on here, the locals or a journalist like you coming to try to experience it and having your a little bit of whiplash?
You know, for locals, it's just the way things are here. And for some of them, I think it was a sense of like, why do you keep coming back here? Like, what makes you so interested in this place? Like, for them, it's just a fact of life that the world's largest fully steerable telescope is in their backyard, or that they don't have cell service, or that this notorious neo-Nazis were down the street, or that Patch Adams isn't really who, you know, he is portrayed in the movie Patch Adams starring Robin Williams. For them, like, it's not so weird. And it kind of takes, like, a new perspective coming in and looking at it. So, yeah, I think I'm the one suffering a lot more of whiplash than the locals.
And then that final question I've already asked you, your plans for your connection to the place going forward. What's the future going to hold?
Well, I'm back here now because I'm catching up with people and doing a couple of book-related events. I'm going to be in the big town of Marlington, which has a couple hundred people, tomorrow doing a book talk in the afternoon. This is a place that I find fascinating, and it will continue to be on the front lines of this discussion over, can we live a more disconnected life? Is there at least going to be one place in America that can resist the total wireless revolution and manage to stay a little bit more disconnected going forward? You know, as Green Bank goes, so goes the rest of the world in a very real sense. Like, if even Green Bank can't resist being always connected, what hope do the rest of us have for keeping some bit of, you know, sanity in our own lives and taking a break from our devices? So this is a place that's going to continue to fascinate me, and I'm going to continue coming back for many years to come, I think.
Stephen Kersey, such a great story to share with us, and thanks for all of your thanks for embedding yourself in a community like that. How long were you there to figure this all out?
Yeah, so I first came here in 2017, was working on the book for 4 years or so, and I spent about 4 months on the ground here in the Green Bank area.
Stephen Kersey, a delight to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. This is fun.
Kersey's book is titled The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. The dose makes the poison, goes the old adage. And if it is true that a dose of quiet could cure many modern maladies, too much silence can cause problems. We're going to turn next to a writer who thrives on quiet, but knows more about an excess of silence than you or I probably ever will. This is Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Jane Brox is a writer, and like most writers, she thrives on quiet. But she's also known the disquiet caused by silence in extreme forms. In her case, living on a lonely island in her youth. Brox thinks that experience may have motivated her to write Silence, a Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives.
I don't think I can define silence because, in fact, it's a mutable quality in our lives. Is it an absolute? Is it something we are listening for, or is it something we're trying to impose on something? Is it silence to me is a series of questions. It's not so much anything that can be defined.
Is it, well, the words that have come to my mind once I became acquainted with you and your work on this book, I was thinking about, well, there's silence, there's quietness, there's solitude, which might not have to do with the science of vibrations at all. That's just being alone. But then there, from solitude, that's one flavor, but you could have isolation. And then I was thinking about just the word emptiness. Are you trying to go down all of those roads?
Not really. I'm trying to explore what silence is to the idea of silence is to humanity in a way. What we we have created these ideas of silence in a way. We've created the idea of silence. We've built monasteries around the idea of silence. We've built penitentiaries around the idea of silence. And silence to me is far more complex than just being quiet, because I think in silence, silence in every instance I've come to think holds both its positive and negative qualities. So even if I'm thinking I'm seeking silence, I have to ask myself, well, what is it I'm seeking? Am I seeking a way to keep others from me by isolating myself in this idea I have a silence, or am I searching for some higher quality? Does that make sense?
Well, the thing that interests me the most is where you said there are the positive and the negative. Are we talking about simultaneously that when we experience silence, there's going to be the pluses and the minuses?
I think silence holds that capacity in it at all times, so that, in fact, one could achieve a place that Thomas Merton was longing for, where silence spoke to one eloquently. But at the same time, that kind of silence is never stable, because in our human minds, it can shift. We can become uncomfortable in it. We can become impatient with it, and then its negative starts creeping in. So I think that silence is it's an idea we have. It's something we're looking to achieve. It's something we also look to control our environment in a way.
Now, you've mentioned monasteries, you've mentioned penitentiaries, and we've talked a little bit. I mentioned Merton, you've mentioned Merton. Let's spend a little time with this Thomas Merton. Tell us why you have such interest in what he had to say about silence.
Well, I think, when I began writing the book, say, 6 years ago, I hadn't thought of Merton being a central character, but he's someone I've been reading for almost 40 years. I started reading him in college, and I've returned to him over the decades. And I returned to him, as part of the research for my book. And the more I read him, the more I thought his articulations about silence are so important, because he himself struggled so with it. He longed for it. It kept changing over the decades. His own encounters with silence changed over the decades. And he was able to, in his journals, in his autobiographies, and in his essays, address so many different qualities of silence that I found he had to be sort of the central human character of the monastic journey for me.
This silence, the way he uses the word, and I mentioned the absence of vibrations, kind of the scientific mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. The way he uses the word, it's going to have all kinds of synonyms that are possible. And I just wonder how broad that range can go. I don't think he was talking about the absence of vibration.
No, he wasn't. In fact, I'll actually go to John Cage to talk about that, because John Cage said, silence is not acoustic. It's a turn of mind. It's a change of mind, a turning around. And I think silence is sort of it's not so much, there's always sound in the world. Even in Thomas Merton's hermitage, he could hear the rain falling and the birds singing, and he termed that silence. It's not so much the lack of sound, it's the lack of bombardment into the human mind, so that there's space. I think of it as a place of space and breadth in which to come to realization.
So that sounds to me like you like this notion of seeking this silence that is a turning of the mind.
I love it. In my work as a writer, I depend on it. I mean, I work in silence all day. I need silence before I settle into work. I need silence after work in order for the work to sort of settle back away from my life. So I'm always, but there are days when that other, when the negatives come in, when the silence does, when sort of setting myself up in the silent world just doesn't seem to be enough. And that, to me, is a really interesting thing, how it isn't stable in my life.
And this John Cage quote, could you help me again with what he called silent? The silence is a, did you say a turning of the mind? Or
He said it's not acoustic, it's a turning around, a change of mind, a turning around.
Just within the last month, I read, and I can't remember the details, but there was some performance artist person who staged a concert where the audience was invited in and sat in silence with each other side by side for half an hour, I believe it was, an exact half hour before the event began. And there was a turning for them as I read the description, the review, that at first it was very awkward, and eventually there was something rich that happened. And it was setting the stage, in a way, for all the sounds that would follow. Do you see silence as oftentimes being the thing that sets the stage?
Yes, I think it can have that quality in that it, as I said before, it kind of opens up a space in the mind. It helps the mind, actually, I think, to it helps the mind to then have things come into a mind. You know, if your mind is all cluttered with five or six different obligations, what chance for a new thought or a new feeling or a new expression to enter? There's not much thought time for that. But if there's quiet, then you can have that experience of being surprised by your own feelings or thoughts or ideas.
So do you think people who are monks might have an edge on this over people like me who are not?
Well, that's their life. I think all of us can find, you know, we don't need to be we don't need to dedicate our lives to it, but all of us can find those quiet times in our life in which to reorient the busier times. In fact, life in the monastery is very busy, and that was sometimes one of Thomas Merton's complaints, because they have to provide for themselves. They have to support the monastery. They're obliged to go to services throughout the day. You know, they're on a very regular clock, in a way. So they don't always have quiet time alone. And I think those obligations also highlight the importance of that time alone and highlight the importance of the quiet. So it's a community. They have an obligation to each other. They have an obligation to make the community itself work. So their silence isn't a selfish silence. And in fact, their seeking of silence and their search in that silence all has to do with the betterment of humanity at large.
Sounds to me like that was with a healthy community as the object in mind.
Right. Right.
Let's go now to some place where destroying community was the aim. There's a really creepy place called Eastern State Penitentiary. I believe it's in Philadelphia, is that correct?
It is. When it was constructed in 1829, it was on the outskirts of Philadelphia, but today it's right in the city limits, not far from the city center, in fact.
And one of our founding fathers was the one who set this up.
Correct. Benjamin Rush, who was a Quaker, and he was... At the time, he was looking for an alternative to the blood punishments of hanging and branding and whipping. They were looking for a more humane system of criminal justice. And he came up with the idea of a penitentiary in which each criminal would be housed in his own cell and would be submitted to both silence and solitude within that cell for the duration of their sentence, be it a year or 2 years or 12 years. And he based it on the idea of the monastic cell, believing that in that silence and in that solitude, the prisoner, and with spiritual guidance, the prisoner would come to a recognition of his faults and remake himself as fit for society.
Well, if Benjamin Rush was from the Quaker tradition, then silence played an important role in his sense of religiosity, and so he saw this as good medicine, I guess.
He did, and I think what he didn't take into consideration when he was thinking of the monastic cell was how important community is for monastics, that, you know, a hermitage is something reserved for someone a very seasoned monk. And monks are only given permission to be hermits in very rare circumstances. But he was actually asking all these 18, 19, 20-year-old offenders who'd never had any experience like this in their lives to, in fact, become hermits.
So have you yourself done any time in the Eastern State Penitentiary?
I have visited. It now stands as a stabilized ruin. And, in fact, I think that was a work of genius to keep it that way, because you can still see several of the cells as virtually as they once were, but in a little bit of a state of decay. But you can see the only light they had was an 8-inch oculus cut into a barreled ceiling. So it was considered the eye of God, and it was enough light by which to read the New Testament. You can see just how small their world was. And, of course, a lot of the prisoners, they may have gone into the penitentiary with all kinds of physical or mental problems, and many of them certainly emerged much worse for their experience.
Was this the first time that people saw this approach as being correctional?
It was the first time on such a large scale that this was taken up. This idea that this kind of punishment would lead to redemption. And their isolation was meant to be absolute. In reality, it didn't turn out that way. The idea is different from the actual outcome. But they were meant to hear almost no noise. The guards would wear socks on their shoes as they brought the lunch around so that they couldn't hear the guards approaching the cell. They were meant not to know how many other people were in the prison with them or where they were, in fact, in the prison. They were meant to be entirely disoriented in space as well.
And this idea of solitary confinement, we've still been grappling with that even in recent years in terms of, is it cruel and unusual punishment, right?
Correct. And solitary confinement today isn't... In 1829, these were sentences meted out by the courts of law. Today, nobody is sentenced to solitary confinement. It's a punishment within punishment. It's the prison officials put people in solitary when they think that they've need to be protected or have transgressed within the prison. And in fact, in our modern times, and I think this is probably symbolic of our time, solitary confinement can be a very noisy place. Silence is no longer considered to have the kind of value it did that Benjamin Rush envisioned.
Now, before I let you go, earlier you said you love silence, that it's part of your environment for being a writer, that you have to have that to do your work. Have you also just had a horror of this silence that would resemble something like solitary confinement? You've never been subjected to solitary confinement, but isn't there something terrible that you feel might somehow enter into your life as a writer?
Well, that's interesting. I think my first comprehensive exposure to real silence came when I was in my early 20s and I was taking care of a house way out on the end of an island, and I had almost no radio reception, no television, and the silent nights really were a trial for me very often. And so I did encounter silence in that sort of big awfulness that in which it can be encountered, and I can't say for sure, but that might have been part of the impetus for this book. Almost 40 years later, to examine why that experience was so profound and so unsettling to me.
We're not going to cover everything in your book, obviously, but could you tell us what Prisoner's Cinema is?
The Prisoner's Cinema is when the prisoners put in solitary confinement begin to hallucinate because they in a dark cell. If the prisoners at Eastern State, if they violated the rules, they could be put in a dark cell, so they had no orientation at all, so that the inner mind began projecting visions for them. And that could have been, you know, that could have well been the source of religious visions as well.
Yeah. In our last couple minutes here, we don't have much time. Would you make some kind of prescription for how we might approach silence and see it as a value in our life? We've talked about the bright side and the dark side and how they sometimes conjoined. What do you think people should do in the quest for a better life if silence is going to be part of the picture?
Well, I think, you know, I think maybe we all could learn to value silence a bit more. And I think one of the ways to begin to do that, it might seem like an overwhelming thing to bring a little bit of silence into your life, but I would say you could always start small. You could always start, you know, with 15 minutes a day somewhere, and then just see what happens within that time and maybe expand it a little bit or have another 15 minutes of just, you know, just putting everything aside and sitting in silence and solitude and see what happens, see what comes in. But, you know, I think it's silence to me is a way to make other qualities in life more vibrant. You know, silence to me makes conversation more essential. It makes me value the times I have in silence and solitude make me value the times I have with other people all that much more.
Jane Brocks is the author of Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. When humans clash with wild animals, for better or worse, it's the Homo sapiens who usually come out on top, but the animals often get their licks in, such as a time when seagulls, showing an utter lack of decorum, invaded St. Peter's Square in the Vatican and destroyed thousands of flowers before the Pope's annual Easter Mass.
It was Easter Sunday, Easter Mass. The Pope says Mass out on the balcony over St. Peter's Square, up to 80,000 people in attendance, huge floral display, massive trucks, refrigerated trucks drive down from the Netherlands, three of them, I think. And it takes all day to set up this flower display, 6,000 daffodils, thousands of cut roses. And the night before, in the wee hours, these gulls came in and wreaked havoc. There were pots overturned, roses strewn about. It was kind of a mess.
From dive bombing seagulls to murderous trees to unruly emus, it's a jungle out there. Next hour, we'll be talking about the sometimes maddening efforts to control the wild kingdom. This is Constant Wonder.